Today's program has been brought to you by Many Kitchens, the one-stop shop for all things foodie. Discover the best artisanal foods that America has to offer. Shop for more at manykitchens.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and we're here in Brooklyn, actually a very sunny, unseasonably warm day here, but I've got a really cheesy show today, in the best way possible, that is. I actually just came from a little wine and cheese party last night, and it just seems so perfect for any party or especially, you know, your Thanksgiving or other holiday get-togethers to have a nice little cheese board to start off the night. And, you know, it's just perfect for this season, this type of weather. So I'm really pleased to have on Sue Conley. She is the co-author of the Cowgirl Creamery Cooks book just out from Chronicle and also the co-founder of Cowgirl Creamery based in Marin County, California. How are you, Sue?
Good.
Good to have you. So I'm really excited about this beautiful book and definitely want to talk about the fascinating story that led to your starting the Cowgirl Creamery in 1997. But just to back up a little bit, talk a little bit about the artisan and farmstead cheese movement in this country as a whole, because it's a fairly new movement. And correct me if I'm wrong, because it seems to me like the artisan and farmstead cheese making growth is a little bit similar to that of American wines and vineyards here. It's a European tradition that's taken root in a new land with new terroir and entrepreneurs like yourself, correct?
That's true. Though dairying is a little messier than winemaking, we'll say.
Okay.
So it doesn't have quite the romantic appeal.
Mm.
And it's not a, well, maybe it is addictive.
Mm-hmm. True.
I think there are some things in cheese that make you just want more.
Mm.
But artisan cheese in the U.S. is growing, and we do take a lead from the European kind of appellations,
yeah.
Traditions, and the spirit of terroir.
Right, and the craft, too, I bet. I was a little surprised that that it has been just really burgeoning in the last, few decades, because we've had dairy farms, and we have had farms in this country ever since the very beginning. Haven't farmers been making cheeses all along?
Well, there are cheese-making traditions. You know, we have our cheddars from New England, and out here in California we have Vella Dry Jack, you know, the kind of Parmesan substitute.
Yeah, I noticed that in a recipe. Yeah.
Yeah, and then really, though, we don't have traditions for goat dairying or sheep dairying, and
that go back
those are
that far.
Very new.
Okay.
And you can trace back to the goat dairies started in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
with kind of the back to the land movement.
Right.
And out here in California, we had Lori Chanel, whose fresh goat cheese was popularized by Chez Panisse.
Mm.
That's the one menu item that's always on the menu is the greens with the baked goat cheese.
Mm.
But before that, it really, and on the East Coast, there was Vermont butter and cheese, got it going. And
mm-hmm.
we also had Humboldt Fog out here, the Cypress Grove goat.
Right.
So these were people who were really, had been to Europe and were exploring agriculture in a new way, and
right.
They started the American Dairy Goat Association, and also the American Cheese Society started in about 30 years ago.
In the 70s.
Yeah, and that brought people together to
learn
to make better cheese.
Right, and it's interesting, though, because we've certainly been eating cheese as a culture this whole time, but this growth of the farmstead and artisan cheese really took off in the 70s, and what happened in between now? Is it just... Were all these farmsteads just not making cheese feasible for them, and we were just
that's
reserving?
Correct.
Yeah,
we were really moving. You know, the whole industrialization of the food system post World War II. So out in California, Albert Strauss, who we buy our milk from, he started the first certified organic dairy in our state, in the West. And in addition, he started to bottle milk on the farm.
Okay.
You know, before World War II, everybody did that.
Everybody did that, right.
I think there were like 35 dairies that bottled their own milk just in the two counties north of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So he was bringing this back, that was a tradition.
Okay.
Also, there could be butter making and ice cream making, or what they called grade A dairy products,
mm-hmm.
made on the farm.
Okay, so, like yogurt or something.
Right.
Right. Okay. And it was fascinating to read that when you first applied for a permit for a cheese making business in Point Reyes, it was the first time they had received such an application in about 50 years.
Correct.
For a new cheese business.
Yeah, we had the Marin French Company has been operating for about 100 years nonstop, and they do make very small format French-style, brie-style cheeses. Mm-hmm. But besides them, there was no one else in Marin, and we had about 3 ongoing cheesemakers in Sonoma County. And if you fast forward to today, mm-hmm. we have a total of 30.
Wow.
And most of these new cheesemakers in the last 5 or 6 years are on-farm cheesemakers.
It's a farmstead, right.
Yes, they come from dairy families, and the kids are coming back to the farm.
So interesting, because you and Peggy Smith, who is the co-founder of the creamery and also the co-author of this book, came to it from a culinary background rather than agricultural.
Correct.
So that's quite different from the earliest, I guess, cheesemakers who were, I guess, farmers.
Yeah, and I think that it's an important link.
Yeah.
You know, we have this connection to the consumer, you know, both in retail and restaurants, that the ranchers, even though they work 60 miles from the center of San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
I mean, many of them we brought to the city for it was like their second or third trip into
mm-hmm.
town. So how could they know what the demand is? Or, you know, delicious cheese and butter and yogurt.
Fascinating. And I was really surprised when I read that it took you about 3 years after applying for that permit to actually open Cowgirl Creamery, because there was a lot of protestations of folks who were against growth in this farmland in the Marin County. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, we are at the entrance to a national seashore, the Point Reyes National Seashore,
mm-hmm.
that was founded in the 70s. And so it protected this magnificent wild land. It also protected ranches that had been operating since the Gold Rush days. They became part mm-hmm. of the park and continue to produce milk and beef out on these beautiful pastures. So the fear for the townspeople was that too many tourists would come.
Oh, okay. I see.
Okay. So, that was the threat.
Because at the same time, you're starting this creamery to help revive the tradition, but also the struggling, you know, small family dairy farms in the region to support them and buy milk from.
Correct. So initially that was really, it was a bit of a conflict, but
mm-hmm.
honestly, over time, you know, those same people who protested our little business downtown mm-hmm. are our best customers, and they're so proud to have food made from the place that they live.
Wow. Well, I think you might call it Courageous Cowgirl Creamery too. Because, well done. Thank you. I mean, it's a wonderful addition to, you know, the culinary landscape, and also helping revive all these, you know, there's all these new artisan cheesemakers today. So much respect. What exactly is artisan too? Like, what, I know that farmstead means it's made on the farm that the cows are raised, or the animals, the goats and so forth. Artisan is a little trickier for me to pinpoint. Is it has to do with quantity and scale?
Yeah, there's size. Not a definition. I mean, we do look at scale,
uh-huh.
and we also look at batch size.
Okay.
You know, because the word can easily be manipulated.
Right. Okay.
But, and we also look at milk source. So, for instance, the cheeses we make, each one has a specific milk source. So we work with three different organic dairies now, and one is 100% Jersey, one is mostly Jersey with Holstein, that's the Strauss milk, and then a third dairy that's 100% Holstein. So that each one works better in certain cheese styles. So we like to define artisan, you know, that the cheesemaker is working with milk from specific farms.
Okay.
And not. I mean, sometimes it is blended milk, but
it makes a difference in taste and your outcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
at least we need to know where that milk's coming from. It's not just, you know, a commodity blend.
Right. So yeah, to control your product, too.
Yeah.
So help me out here. So now that I know, you know, a little bit more about artisan and small scale and the fact that it's this, you know, kind of a growing movement, which is a very exciting and encouraging phenomenon happening now. When I'm navigating cheeses in a cheese store, sometimes I'll come across a similar style of cheese from maybe a similar region. They're both artisan, technically, but some will have wildly different price tags. And it leads me to wonder, okay, well, so what are all the other, you know, ramifications is that any indicator of a better quality if it's a higher price tag?
Not necessarily, but you'll see that goat milk cheeses tend to be a little more expensive than cow milk, and sheep are even higher in price. So that's because those animals don't produce very much milk. So it takes a lot more.
They're smaller.
Yeah, they have smaller tanks.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that makes it more expensive. Mm-hmm. And then European cheeses are subsidized on some level because first they've been doing it for so long that they don't have the kind of startup cost that American cheesemakers have. And then they promote their farmers in ways that small farmers, you know, are honored and subsidized, whereas here small producers are almost punished because such an expensive entry cost, and just the, you know, the whole infrastructure of farming here is not in favor of small producers.
Interesting. So, yeah.
And if it's handmade, you know, the other thing we're trying to do, I mean, I can't speak for other cheesemakers, but I know it's part of the ethic that is part of our community, is to pay people well, to really turn this into a career profession and not just, you know, a unskilled
low wage
job. So that starts at the milk, paying the farmer what he deserves for his milk, and hoping that they pass that on to their workers, treat their animals well, and then we have professional people all the way through our business, from the the cheese wrapper all the way through to the cheesemonger at the counter. These are skilled people, and they're devoted to this as a career.
Well, those are
trying to kind of bring it all up.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a million different other reasons, too, but these are some really great clues, and I'm sure, you know, each individual story is so fascinating on its own, and that's why it's so fun to try different artisan cheeses and learn a little bit more about them when you go to the cheese shop. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about your book, of course, and your wisdom about how to serve cheese, but we're going to have a quick little commercial interlude, and we'll be right back chatting more with Sue Conley.
You are listening to Crying Blues by the California Honey Drops on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
At manykitchens.com, you can enjoy decadent caramel brownies, hand-picked teas, and fair trade coffee, oven-roasted chicken pot pies, and so much more. Whether you're planning a dinner party, sending a gift, or just want to try something new and delicious, Many Kitchens offers something for everyone. Help support small batch producers while you discover the best in artisanal foods from across the nation at manykitchens.com. Many Kitchens, the one-stop shop for all things foodie.
We're back with Sue Conley, author, co-author of the Cowgirl Creamery Cooks book, and just talking about the fascinating story about the rise of the business, Cowgirl Creamery. And also this cookbook talks a lot, since you have a great culinary background, both you and Peggy Smith, that is, about how to serve cheese. So help me out here. I know that the French can be a little bit, you know, ritualistic about how to serve a proper cheese board or cheese plate. What are some, like, the go-to, or are there any hallmarks or traditions that I should keep in mind when arranging a holiday or any occasion that is a cheese board? Do I need to have one of different type or different goat or, you know, different animal milk? Or are there any rules?
We do talk about that in one of our chapters, different ways to think about a cheese course. And it is good to go into it with a certain point of view, as we put it. And one way is to do a regional cheese course.
Ooh.
And that's really fun.
Yeah.
You know, and it doesn't have to be your own region, but it could be your own region. Look at the farmer's market, see what's going on, or the local cheese shop. And it is nice to, in that case, if you can find a cheese from all three milk types, that's really fun.
Cool.
We also make a point that we like to have, like, three or five on the board.
Oh.
That seems to be a nice balance with something sweet and something nutty, you know.
Sweet,
and
nutty.
Eat,
mm-hmm.
You know, some honey or some jam, and then walnuts or pecans on the board. And another way is to just get three of the same style cheese, like a brie style.
Oh, really?
In all three milks.
Oh. Oh, that
because
sounds fun.
They all look the same, but they're dramatically different. And Peggy never, ever wants me to put a blue cheese on the board. But I think it's okay to do that. She worries that it's so strong that if you eat it out of sequence, which at a party, everybody will just be, you know, attacking it from every direction.
Uh-huh.
She's afraid that it, you know, kind of negates the other subtle flavors. So she always puts if she's going to serve a blue, she'll put it on a different plate with accompaniments that
work with the blue, I see, on its own. That's a really good idea, and I love...
So those are a few tips.
Well, thank you. I'm going to try out one soon. And, you know, this book really changed my opinion because I always thought with really, really amazing, unique artisan cheeses, I thought there was no better way to serve them than just as they were, this carefully crafted product. But you have a lot of great ideas for cooking with them slightly, and then, you know, just serving with them in a salad, in a lasagna, in a grilled cheese. I love this ricotta asparagus souffle. Also, never would have thought of that. Cottage cheese dumplings. Some really good ideas that are just so delicious looking. Tell me a little bit about this fromage blanc making instructions here, because what is fromage blanc? This is a cheese you can make.
When we're writing this book, you know, we don't want people to think if they buy it, they can learn how to make cheese, but they can learn how cheese is made. So there's a difference, right? So we did put one recipe in for making your own fromage blanc.
Yeah, that's the one.
And that is just a really easy way to illustrate all cheese making, you know, the separation of curds and whey. Mm-hmm. And it is a simple recipe. We use a buttermilk as the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Fromage blanc, of course, means white cheese, and it's the simplest cheese to make.
It's like a fresh cow's milk cheese.
It's fresh, and you eat it right away. There's no aging.
So it's similar to a fresh mozzarella or ricotta?
Well, no, because those are cooked curds.
Oh.
This is a fresh, long-set curd. So you set it as you would a yogurt the night before with your cultures, and keep it in a warm environment. In the morning, it looks like yogurt. It's set like yogurt. You scoop it into a cheesecloth sack and let it drain for 4 or 5 hours, and then salt it. And we have a secret ingredient that we put a little bit of creme fraiche in.
I noticed that. Yeah, just to give it a little flavor.
Yeah, and a little, you know, it smooths out the curd.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
That's the first cheese I learned to make, and that's kind of how we explain the categories of cheese as we follow our story of how we learned to make the different styles.
So you first learned about the, the fresh cheeses, so fromage blanc, and then ricotta, mozzarella, and then
feta.
And then the soft, young, aged cheeses, such as Camembert. That sounds very difficult with all the mold on it.
Well, yeah, you do have to have the proper environment to grow the molds and to age them at a high humidity. Yeah, so they're a little tricky at home.
But, yeah.
You really have to build your own cheese-making room.
That's another whole level right there if you're
going
to get into it.
Yeah.
But you do have a great tip on how to serve your Camembert, which I never thought of, which was to slice it in half, height-wise, spread on some sautéed wild mushrooms, and then plunk it back together and serve it like that. I love that idea.
Well, the thing is, you plunk it back together, and then you cover it in plastic wrap and put it back in the fridge, and the white mold will grow over that cut.
Oh.
So it looks like a, it heals.
Oh,
and
that's interesting.
It takes a couple days, and then you can it's a delicious kind of a party.
Is that how some cheeses are made with the layer of ash in between? They're cut and then put back together and then allowed to heal and grow back together?
Well, traditionally, the curd is drained and then the form is filled halfway and the ash is applied and then this form is filled to the top with the remaining curd. So the Morbier is that tradition, and they actually did it in two parts because they used the curd from the morning cheese making and then the evening cheese making.
Oh.
And then the ash was put on as to protect the cheese as it from the air as it sat there waiting for the second half.
Yeah, now that I think about it, the ash wouldn't really be for flavor or anything.
No, it's decorative.
It is decorative.
It does serve a function, but in the Humboldt fog that Mary Keene makes at Cypress Grove, she used the that beautiful style just as decoration, you know, to make her little ash layer in the middle.
Ah, fascinating. So you touched on Humboldt fog, you talk a little bit about the names of the different cheeses and how they can be the names of Cowgirl Creamery's cheeses, for example, are similarly fun, a little playful, and they're just not what you would think of. They're not something that easily comes to mind, like cheddar, or gives you an idea of what it'll taste like. Do you find that explaining what a type of cheese is that you've made is a big part of the fun of giving it a unique name?
Yeah,
in the learning
process.
You bring
up a good point because you know, in Europe they are stuck with their traditions. I mean, their traditions are their base, and we all learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
But they can't deviate. If somebody lives in Roquefort and they want to make cheese, they make Roquefort. You know, there's not a acceptance of new cheeses. That's
right.
Changing a little bit now, but
you know,
that has been the.
But it's so ingrained in the culture too. I bet it's not done with as much glee and fun and delight as the, you know, inventing new cheeses in the land of the free.
I know,
of
it's true.
The free cheesemakers.
We had the cheesemaker from Vacheron come. You know, that's a very stinky
Vacheron
wash drying cheese
okay.
from France, and. He came to see our creamery because he said it's impossible to make a triple cream wash-drying cheese. Cannot be done. That's what we do. We didn't know that it couldn't be done.
Oh!
So,
what is the name of your cheese that's a triple cream?
That one's called Red Hawk.
Red Hawk, all right.
It has a red wash-drined.
And you did the impossible.
We did the impossible because we didn't know.
I just see a picture. So what did he think of the Red Hawk when he tried
impressed.
It?
He
really?
Delicious. Oh, congratulations. Yeah.
that's wonderful. Yeah, I mean when you stick with a certain way of doing things, you might not realize that that it's not impossible to change it up a bit. So what is your favorite cheese from Cowgirl Creamery?
My favorite cheese is my cottage cheese, but right now we can't make it because we've had to re-engineer our cheesemaking room.
Oh.
And so we suspended production temporarily, and I miss it horribly. But in the absence of my cottage cheese, I think I really love our Red Hawk.
Yeah, that sounds like a unique one.
Which is kind of on the other spectrum of flavor.
but it's so...
But I love all cheese.
I feel like it looks like one of those wonderful, exciting, different, unique cheeses. It has that cute, you know, kind of shape that is an individual and looks like it handmade. And it is handmade. So, you know, it's an exciting cheese to have on your board. So, and I've
agree.
Had it. It's delicious
oh, good.
Too.
Oh, good.
So, any last favorite maybe recipe in here or favorite way of serving cheeses that maybe not in the book?
Well, I can say that my grandmother's cheese wafer recipe is in there. It's a cheddar wafer that's a southern recipe from Georgia, and it has a half a pecan on top.
I saw that, yeah.
A little bit of cayenne in there, and so it really does... It's very hard to stop eating these.
Cheese
but they're great,
wafers.
They're a great holiday savory treat. You know,
right.
They're not a sweet cookie.
And it looks pretty easy to make too.
Yeah.
It looks delicious. Well, thank you so much. That's about all the time we have for today, but thank you so much for your time and for the wonderful book. Check out cowgirlcreamery.com. Also, the Cowgirl Creamery Cooks book out from Chronicle just now. Thanks so much, Sue, and thanks everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
I like the way you do.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.